Welcome to Leadership Amplified. This is episode 28, and today I'm delighted to be interviewing Amanda McEnery. Amanda is the head of marketing at homely.com.au, the third largest real estate portal in Australia. Amanda began her career in advertising 13 years ago before a need for both increased flexibility and new career challenges saw her move into the marketing side. Over the past 5 years, she's grown from marketing manager to senior marketing leader, and she's now a key member of the Homely leadership team. Amanda has worked for organizations such as Pepperstone, Australian Unity Wealth, Isobar, and Naked Communications. She's also currently studying her Master of Business Administration at Melbourne Business School.
Cool. Amanda, so thank you very much for joining me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation today.
Thanks for having me, Karen.
Yeah, terrific. So we're going to start in the usual place that I start on Leadership Amplified, which is to ask people to tell us about their leadership journey. It's always fascinating to hear about how people, start their career, develop into leadership roles, and how do they find themselves where they're at right now? So what's the Amanda story?
It's a bit of a higgledy-piggledy one, but I think, Karen, my journey to leadership really began in the last 7 years, even though I've been working for 14 plus. So I guess sometimes finding your path isn't as easy as you might think. I was in my early 20s. Frankly, I'd always wanted to be in advertising, and I remember thinking it was the most incredibly glam and corporate job that anyone could possibly have, and was totally suited to a creative mind like mine. The ad industry itself isn't very easy to break into. It's very much like a Hollywood, or some sort of very low budget Hollywood. It's very much like who you know and having the experience, but to get the experience, you need the experience. I remember when I was in uni dropping my CV off up and down the streets of Auckland, where Saatchi & Saatchi was. I think it was Queen Street from memory, where I used to live. And, putting my hand up to do unpaid internships and generally seeking out some very benevolent copywriting mentors, as that's where I thought I would end up being. In the very start of my career, I was lucky enough to get a foot in the door at a small agency, but it actually turned out to be a complete nightmare. It was a start of about 10 years of sort of overwork, inflexibility, pressure, confusion, and a lack of direction. And I think, there were those moments of glamour and exposure to strategy and amazingly creative people, but there was a lot of uncertainty. And I think over time, I began to realize that I'd tried so hard to make this career suit me that I hadn't actually considered whether I was suited to this career at all.
Oh, right. What an important realization.
And it took a long time. It took a long time. It took like 10 years. But my biggest realization was, frankly, I simply wasn't very good at what I did. And I had no desire to be any better. You know how people say, do you want your boss's job? I remember looking at my managers and thinking, I just really don't want your job. You are working 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, and the pressure in agency land can be a lot, especially for a woman. Anyone sort of trying to balance work and life has a real struggle. I know that the industry is getting better these days, but back then it was pretty tough.
So I'm interested there. You talk about the sort of fit, and that fit didn't work, but then you talked about the skills for it and the capability for it. So where do you think on balance the rub or the lack of connection was?
Yeah, well, I think growing up, I'd always thought of myself as more of a creative person. I was always more into writing or art or any sort of creative thinking, a vivid imagination. So naturally, I thought I would be suited to a copywriter role at an agency. After doing, there's something called award school, which anyone in the Oz industry would know of as sort of the holy grail of what a good copywriter can get into in order to prove themselves and build a folio. I just could not get in, and I just could not get my brain to work in the way that these amazing creatives could. So I ended up choosing account direction, which is the
right.
sort of the suit version of agency.
Right.
It just wasn't, it's actually quite a vulnerable thing to admit, but I just wasn't detailed enough. I wasn't focused enough. I kept getting drawn to the creative side more, strategy side more, rather than focusing on what was quite a black and white part of work. So I felt like I wasn't business minded either. It was a real, it was a period of 9 or 10 years where I just didn't know what kind of career I wanted, what kind of person I wanted to be, and where my interests actually belonged. So I think to find that out, to find out at the end that I was just frankly burnt out, and I always referred to what I did as a bit of a skillless profession because I couldn't quite get good or passionate enough at anything that I did, that I felt that I was just moving pieces around and not really getting anywhere.
So that's a really challenging kind of position to be in. And I think a lot of people can find themselves in that position and maybe you don't come to the realization that that's what's happening. It doesn't feel great and you keep trying. It doesn't feel great, but you do keep trying and you can be caught, I think, in that sort of web. So, Amanda, what was it that helped you break out of that?
Well, I think it got to the point where I was just tired of the industry itself. I realized I wasn't suited to it and I was starting to feel more and more disengaged with it. I thought, well, I'm technically a trained marketer. I'm interested in strategy. I'm going to try and move client side, if only for the work-life balance and exposure to the full strategic process. So working in advertising or even digital advertising, you're exposed to a smaller portion of what a marketing person like myself now would give an agency, or you're exposed to a production element or a certain part of the strategy. I was really interested in viewing the whole commercial strategy and understanding how businesses work. I've always had a fascination for that and no idea how to even sort of scratch that itch. So I think, you know, I realized that I needed to move out, but as hard as it is to get into the ad industry, it's actually even harder to break out because you're typecast into a certain role and personality.
Right.
The amount of times I went for interviews with people that said, are you sure you want to work here? Won't you get bored? Because there's a perception of people in agency land that you just have to be party on all the time, loving working, you know, till 10 p.m. every night. And there's a lot more that I'm sure many people in the industry could say about whether that's right or wrong. But I had to do some real convincing, and I guess after much determination, I finally did get a break and moved into a market manager role, which is fantastic, at Australian Unity. And my manager at the time used to be a client, or she actually used to be in agency land herself. And she said, I know how hard it is for people like us to get out. So I'm going to give you a chance because I know you have all the tools. And it was a seminal role for me. I really admired the place I worked at. I began to flourish from the get-go and enjoy an amazing new career in marketing. I love the calmer, the more calm environment, a process-driven environment where I had access to different people, different parts of the business. I surprisingly discovered this amazing obsession with financial services, which could not have been further from what I would have thought I would be into 5 years ago. And
how do you mean that interest in financial services? So that was in marketing for financial services organizations.
Yeah, so I was working as marketing manager for Big Sky Banking and Australian Unity Bank. And I think it was just the exposure to how powerful and how interesting the money market and the capital markets were and how important banking is to every single human being looking to create a life for themselves or manage their hard-earned money, and the whole ecosystem, the whole everything about it just became incredibly fascinating for me and still does fascinate me. And I also was lucky enough to meet some incredible people along the way who I never would have bumped into in my life had I stayed in agency land. So, yeah, it was a hugely important move for me. And I was excited to start. And, you know, it was the start of what is now quite a financial and property orientated career.
So let's hear then about your interest in leadership and leadership roles and how you've developed and flourished as a leader over time.
Yeah, cool. So I think the main thing I wanted to harness from the get-go was to make up for all those years of sort of treading water and confusion. I actively sought out to better myself at every possible opportunity. So from the minute I started this marketing manager role working for someone else, like in a, you know, a managerial role reporting up to a general manager, I looked at what the role of a general manager was, what I needed to do to roadmap myself there, what kind of mentors I needed to surround myself with to build up the skills that I lacked. So an example there was, you know, I'd never written a marketing strategy myself before. That was all my job. So I actually studied that, met someone, a mentor who taught me how to think more strategically and plan that out. I was Googling like you had no idea. I was speaking to my manager and reviewing all her strategies. And now it's just something I do in my sleep and think in a certain direction. But if there was something I didn't know, I immediately went to apply myself to feel empowered enough to learn about it. Because I did want to be a leader and I wanted to move up pretty quickly. I have a terrible sense of impatience and ambition, but it was a drive to always be better and better myself and learn from things and reflect on things all the time. So,
Why is it terrible, Amanda?
Oh, maybe not terrible.
To do those things.
It can be quite frustrating. My impatience can be frustrating for people around me, but it's definitely, I like the journey, Karen. I like the journey of being impatient. I'm a very goal-oriented person, and if I set my mind to something, I will always try my best to get that thing. And you know, I had a roadmap to become a senior leader in marketing. I have a roadmap in my head of how to become a CMO, and that sort of ticks along pretty much to plan because I work very hard at always trying to better myself and reflect on what I could do to improve.
So with that, I mean, you know, the strong drive, but also a very strong learning kind of focus, and that self-monitoring, being very aware of where you're at and what you're doing and how you're doing it, what else you might do, is something that, you know, really stands out to me.
I think you've got to take the vulnerability with it and admit that no one's great at everything, and you might have said something really stupid during the day that is just filling you with shame, and you're wondering how you can ever sort of recoup that confidence or ego or anything like that. But what I've learned is just to try and put everything in perspective. One bad day out of 365 in a year, you very rarely remember those bad days, and you can always celebrate the good, and they generally always eclipse any bad days you have. So I try not get discouraged by the occasional bad day, or you know, I might have a slip of the tongue or say something that I thought wasn't the smartest thing I could have done. Or, you know, there's no point being super harsh on yourself. It's best to sit there and reflect and go, what did I do? I did the best I could. Next time I can do this. Here's what I need to do to be better. Or here's a gap, an opportunity. Or here's an opportunity to, you know, meet someone like yourself or a mentor or someone who you really admire and learn from what those people have done as well.
Okay, so marketing manager, and you kind of feel at home now. This is where you can use your skills and talents, and it allows your sort of drive and focus to really be well placed. What happened next in the career journey?
So I ended up leaving Australian Unity, and I guess in hindsight, part of me feels like I left a little bit early, but they were going through a restructure. And again, it was impatience. I was so incredibly driven and had a timeline for a promotion that I wanted to achieve. And when I heard that there was a restructure, it was made clear that there would be no sort of moves for anyone in the business for a certain period of time. And
right.
It probably wasn't the best way for me to have managed the uncertainty, but in hindsight, it all worked out really well. So yeah. I actually moved with a colleague of mine to a financial services company called Pepperstone, where I spent the next 3.5 years learning marketing absolutely back to front and immersing myself in the financial markets. I progressed from a consultant to a senior manager into a head of role. And then when my boss left the business, I stepped into her sort of interim leadership role until we hired a CMO. So that change was pretty hectic for me at the time, as it was just the start of COVID, and I sort of fell into the deep end with that, but it was an absolute blessing in disguise. So for anyone who is scared of a change or a big shift or someone leaving or picking up responsibility, my word of wisdom would be to grab it with both hands, because I have never learned so much in such a supportive environment in such a quick period of time that I felt a seismic shift in my career that day. So it was incredibly empowering. It was terrifying. I worked very hard, but it was the best thing that's ever happened in my career.
That's
the abyss. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And I do think, though, that you mentioned support, and I think the greater the challenge you experience, the more support you need. So I think that you can really experience amazingly difficult or big challenges. But if you've got a lot of support, the support matches that, then you could do it, really be propelled or accelerated forward in your career. So where did the support come from?
So the support came from the executive team at Pepperstone. So I had a couple of guys, including the CEO here in Melbourne, but also a chief operating officer over in London, completely support me and tell me I could do it. They never faltered in their belief in me. They kept giving me plenty of work with the complete belief that I would deliver. And I had a fabulous team under me that I consider some of my best friends these days. And everyone had this camaraderie that we were in it together. But also I felt from them a sense of respect into this elevated position and a sense of support in what was a bit of an unknown time for the whole team, especially with the pandemic and the start of working from home and all that stuff, which we can all agree was, everyone was thrown into the deep end in 2020. Yeah. But I think it was also, it was just a fantastic environment to work in. And we all felt like we were part of one team, and that made all the difference to me. So I was really encouraged in my ability and empowered to make some big decisions that would have scared me. And I think being empowered then has taught me just how much value it adds to someone else's life when I empower them. So it's something that I bring along my leadership journey now. And whenever there's a part of me going, well, I should just do that, I can do it better, I stop myself and I say, how good did 2020 Amanda feel when all the big bosses gave her the big work and she had the best time? So I try and pass that on to anyone in my team, and watching them thrive with that empowerment it really does show that you've done a good job as a leader. So
such a powerful experience and opportunity to help others grow. Okay, so Pepperstone to Homely.
Pepperstone to Homely. So I had a little, a tiny bit of a hiccup in between the two, where I chased a dream that wasn't quite a dream, ended up back at Pepperstone on a contract because they're just lovely people who look after me, and then applied to a head of marketing role at Homely, where a friend of mine currently works and who I've known for a number of years. And I got the role as head of marketing and, you know, on the leadership team. I report directly to the CEOs and get to work at a scale up, which is that beautiful space for me in between an established business and a sort of scrappy startup. So it's exactly where I need to be. And it was a small step up for me in terms of experience as well, but I have confidently grown into the role and the senior leadership position due to, again, the belief in my ability from the CEOs, flexibility in the way I work, probably the most flexibility I've ever experienced in my life, and empowerment and support to do what I need to do my job really well.
Yeah. So here you land after those kind of early days, kind of, I don't know, round cogging square hole or whatever it might have been, and then finding your place in marketing, and here you are as head of marketing for an organization. And it's interesting you talk about this idea of fitting in, you know, or a scale up organization being the right fit for you. So what does that mean, and how do you come to that conclusion, apart from finding a nice home at Homely for that?
It's a good question and an interesting one, because scale ups or startups are not for everyone, just like established businesses are also not for everyone. So I think the differences are huge, and it ultimately comes down to the kind of person that you are, how flexible you are with change and uncertainty, and how much energy you should believe or you believe should be allocated to your work life. And I say energy to be allocated because you could be a very energetic person, but you may not want to put all of that energy into your work. You have to sort of meter that out to live a balanced life. But I personally thrive in a high energy environment where I can have the opportunity to make a meaningful difference, particularly in how the business operates, more so than marketing. Marketing is definitely where I play and where I, you know, work day to day. But being able to actually have an imprint on a business and the way a business runs is definitely where I get a lot of my joy and fulfillment at work. So I think working at a scale up is perfect. It's a blend of certainty. You know that the business is operating. It's operating really well. It's got the backing that it needs behind it. It's got purpose and values without too much chaos or ego, without the sort of frantic capital raising that a startup might have, the very embedded processes of a corporate established company, neither of which suit my chosen energy allocation, I guess, for work. But I found a really good definition of a scale-up that I thought I'd bring to you from the OECD, which defines scale-ups as companies who have an average annualized return of at least 20% in the past 3 years with at least 10 employees in the beginning of the period. So Homely, we have a 49% annualized revenue growth year on year. So we're firmly in that space, and we've got that sort of high growth aspect that is super exciting to work on. And we're sitting at around 60 people and growing each year. A lot more than that 10 people, but still with this high growth ambition that really energizes me every day.
Yes, brilliant. And as someone who's doing her MBA, it's not surprising to me that you quote a reference in order to answer a question.
You're doing that now.
Yeah. So where do you think, you know, especially given the interest in scale-ups, working in scale-ups, where does an MBA fit into that?
So I actually originally wanted to study an MBA at around the end of my advertising career, as I was in my find myself phase, trying to figure out what it was that I wanted to do. So I think study is always a dimension that you look at when you are trying to seek change. Well, maybe I need to go back and learn another skill. Or I think that's very much the imposter syndrome playing up again, where you feel like maybe if you learned something more, or you just became 100% fluent in something, maybe then you'd be better at your job, or your job would suit you more, etc. But I chose not to do it that early on for a couple of reasons. I ended up randomly taking up running and decided to do a marathon instead and get all that energy. So I just mentally wasn't ready for it. I needed to do some more soul searching. So my husband and I both have wanted to pursue, we both have a keen interest in how business works. And it's all great. There are critics of study who say, well, you know, you don't need an MBA. It's expensive. It's a lot of time. You can just ask people at work and learn on the job. I have been very close with many CFOs in my life, and they do not have time to take you through the three financial statements and what each of them mean unless you're prepared to spend many, many dollar figures taking them out for an expensive dinner to thank them for their time. There's no chance I could have learned anything about what I'm learning now through the good grace of someone at work teaching me how. So it is exposure to the different facets of business that have just kept me so interested over the last 7 years, how the financial markets work, giving me an economic lens, a more business, a corporate strategy lens rather than a brand strategy lens. And I feel studying the MBA has helped me have more intellectual conversations at a higher level. I have more confidence in my ability. As you know, I used to be terrified of all things quant, and now I look forward to learning and have a patience with myself that I didn't have before. So, it's challenging. It's exciting. I am so grateful that my husband is doing it, and I could not imagine one of us doing it without the other. So
it's such a huge commitment, isn't it? When you're working full time, you're almost studying full time when you're doing an MBA. Right. So it's a big investment.
It's now taking up such a large percentage of our conversation. I have nothing but appreciation for people who have to do it individually, or, you know, someone whose partner's doing it who has to sort of plug in that conversation. It's fantastic. It's definitely the best thing I've ever done. Yes, it's expensive. It takes a lot of time, but it is exactly what I need to be doing at this time in my life. And I look forward. The day I finish.
Yes. Yeah, that will be a very important day. And obviously it also plays into that interest you have in how the whole business works.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of a quick way to get yourself across that. Yeah. So, Amanda, tell us a little about your leadership style. I'm very interested. If I was a member of your team, or perhaps your collegiate team, your peers on the leadership team, you know, what would I see apart from the high energy, which I reckon we've already got now? What will we see in terms and what will we experience of you?
Yeah, sure. So I think one thing I've been conscious of is ensuring that how I present myself at work is as professional but as honest as possible. I don't really bring my whole self to work. I don't feel like that's necessarily appropriate for myself, or not because I'm too different outside of work, but I do think that my personal view is that having something to keep back and an air of professionalism is important. So anyone in my team or in my stakeholder network does know me, but I think unless I become quite good friends with the person, they won't fully know the personal side of me, and that's okay. I think it helps keep a sense of professionalism and leadership and credibility to a degree at work. That being said, I tend to form very good friendships or close friendships with the people in my team, because that's when I let myself be completely myself, and I encourage them to do exactly the same, because I want them to feel like work is a place where whether we're hybrid, dialing in, or in person, where they can feel comfortable enough to bring their whole selves to work if they choose to do that. I'm also really interested and curious about personality differences. So something that we did study that made a lot of sense was the Big Five Ocean Framework. So similar to the Myers-Briggs, how people score themselves on openness, introversion, extroversion, conscientiousness, perceiving, judging, etc. And I think having that sort of lens, I make sure that I tend to tailor my communication to the person I'm speaking to. I might be quite friendly and overly warm to someone who I know enjoys being spoken to in that way or spoken with in that way. Whereas for more analytical people, what I've learned over the years is, you know, some people prefer to be more task-oriented, more analytical focused, and they don't necessarily want to have a big chat about the weekend. So I'll make sure that I sort of tailor my communication to them. Mm. And that's doing not just myself a favor in terms of becoming more effective, but it's also honoring each person's individual personality and the way that they prefer to communicate. It's how I get things through a lot of the time in a more efficient and effective way, finding out how someone prefers to be communicated with and really leveraging that. Managing my team, as I mentioned earlier, empowerment is huge for me, and I'm very happy to delegate something that will help my team shine and help them derive a pleasure and joy from being at work and doing the work. I'm incredibly output focused, so I don't mind if someone needs to start later or anything like that. It doesn't even faze me at all, as long as the work gets done and in a way that provides good outcomes rather than just outputs. I always make sure to have one-on-ones with people and keep to them and ask them about themselves, not make it about me or the work. So that's something that I learned over the years as well, which is a very handy hint to keep people engaged and happy in the team. So
I think that's it's really interesting that you mentioned that piece about, you know, the whole self. And I think there's a lot around, you know, prescriptions to make sure that people can bring their whole selves to work. And I think it's, you know, between us and everyone listening, it's a bit of an empty statement, because, you know, what does it if you bring your whole self, you bring your party self, you bring your silly self, you bring all sorts of other selves. So I think what you've said is that you're making choices about which part of yourself you bring into different relationships and conversations. And to me, that's just about kind of being smart to think about what's the context and how can I get the best impact, be most effective in that context. And there are always boundaries, so being aware of the boundary that you're playing to or within, managing your own sense of boundary, I think is really an important thing to do. And it's more important than just coming out with this, let's all bring our whole selves to work.
I only imagine that sort of statement or movement came from, you know, being in quite a stuffy environment or some environment where, you know, people felt like they couldn't be open enough. I guess a psychologically unsafe environment. Potentially that is directed at people who hypothetically could have led those psychologically unsafe environments, you know. But I think psychological safety is the most important thing for any company, big, small, medium, whatever, but any team in any company. If you don't have that psychological safety in when it comes to communication or the way that your teams are operating, you can be guaranteed that you'll have absenteeism, turnover, unhappy people, and a whole bunch of outputs that just won't move the needle at all. So that's definitely
a great point. Focusing on making a safe environment, then people can bring in, they can make the choice about how much of themselves they bring in, but feel comfortable to speak up, which is its point. All right, well, Amanda, thank you so much for sharing your journey, and I think that's an interesting take around the scale up and the focus and being clear about why that's the right kind of context for you and for your leadership style. So just as we finish up the conversation, do you have any last words of advice, suggestions for other leaders about things that they might do or consider to help increase their success?
Of course, I keep a little logbook in my head of my journey over the last 7 years. And all I can say is that you need to surround yourself with inspiration. So whether it's the way someone presents or how someone designs presentations, there's something to learn from everyone around you. And people love being asked for help and to give advice. So if you admire something about someone else that you think is an opportunity for you to work on, if you're not very good at, I'm using PowerPoint as an example, but if you're not very good at designing a presentation, find someone who is, tell them you think they do a great job and ask them to teach you. That way you're creating a network, you're learning something else, you're not battling through subpar outputs, and you can sleep at night knowing you've done what you can to be better. So I constantly surround myself I constantly surround myself with people who I admire, and I try and take away something positive from everyone that I meet, and learn how to be a better leader from everyone. So I've got a few people in my head. They may not even know that I know them, but I admire them and I try and emulate them in different ways. So some really good mentors or inspirational people out there. Christine Holgate is one that I can reel off. And Adia Schiffman is another voice on LinkedIn who I really respect. So I do follow everything that those people post and try and learn communication styles and just general classiness from people like that. The other thing I would say is support people to do their very best and be their very best, and be prepared not to get praise for it either. Be really comfortable never getting praised again. And if your team gets praised, you can be happy and know that you've done a good job as a leader. So I think that's a true sign of a leader. If you're completely comfortable foregoing any praise and giving that to your team, then you've made it. So something I keep in mind. And finally, I suggest being real with yourself about what you can improve. Whether it's a weakness or an opportunity, however you prefer to look at it, be honest, take the ego out of it and say, maybe, you know, public speaking is not my strength. I'm going to really focus on that. I'm going to see a coach. I'm going to definitely finish those books that I promised myself I would. I'm going to take notes about it and I'm going to practice. Whatever it is, actively, consciously focus on improving them, because just like running a marathon or studying or anything else, you need to put the practice in. It doesn't just come to people who say, oh, well, I'm not good at it, so there. So I'm pretty real with myself about what I can improve, and I'm always trying to improve.
Yeah, and I tell you what, Amanda, that's come across in very loud volume in this conversation. So you have provided a context in which we can all be inspired. So I really like that emphasis you put around, you know, don't wait for inspiration to come to you, to seek you out and find you. Go out and find it, and find it in all sorts of ways, in all sorts of people. That's fantastic. So I think that's a great way to finish up the conversation. Thank you so much again for joining me for today and for this conversation. It's been just fantastic.
Thanks so much. What a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on, Karen.